Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Rebecca McEnroy. Over the next hour, I'll talk with the writer, director, and creator of the intergalactic nemesis, Jason Newlander. Hope you enjoy the show. The Intergalactic Nemesis, it's amazing. It's a project that, you know, started in a coffee shop. It's been on these huge stages at the Long Center. It's been all over the world. Now it's a podcast and a web series and all of that good stuff. It's so great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And as you can tell, we have this stage set up for a little bit of the show.
A little surprise.
A little surprise at the end. Yeah. But before we get to it, let's start out by talking about how you developed as an artist. Were your parents amazing, crazy theater people who brought you and exposed you to all of this incredible theater and sparked this creativity at a young age?
They were those people, actually. My mom, I grew up right outside of New York City in a little town called Montvale, New Jersey. And did somebody say yeah?
Where? Who? It's, really?
Wait. So, what? Oh my God. Well, of course, if you've driven north to, if you've driven through the Garden State Parkway into New York State, then you have driven through Montvale, because we are the last exit on the Garden State Parkway. Because
wow.
People from New Jersey really do define themselves by their exit.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not, yeah. It's a joke on old Saturday Night Live skit,
yeah.
But it's actually
New
reality.
Jersey.
Yeah. So, but anyway, my mom grew up in New York, and she was an avid theater goer. So when me and my sister were kids, she would regularly take us into the city, and we'd go to museums, or we'd go and see Broadway shows. And I have this very, very clear memory. Really defining moment of my childhood. I think it may have, I can't remember if it was my birthday or my sister's birthday, but we were in the front row of the mezzanine at the theater at which Peter Pan with Sandy Duncan was playing. And in the curtain, I mean, I loved all that music and all that, but in the curtain call, Peter Pan flew over the orchestra section and then just for a moment flew nose to nose with me. And really, and I was floored, and my parents were, I was amazed. I mean, it was magic. And my parents were like, well, couldn't you see the rope? And I was like, what rope? So for me, that moment as a kid, I've thought about this a lot, actually, in my career, that the idea of taking the simplest of means, you know, attaching somebody to a harness and a wire and having them just swing themselves out over the audience. If you suspend your disbelief, that simple thing becomes magic. And that is the thing that I have tried to strive for in my work, both formerly at Salvage Vanguard Theater and now with Intergalactic Nemesis. I found that the most interesting work, for me as an artist at any rate, is work that takes the simplest of parts but puts them together in a way where the whole is much greater than the sum of those individual parts. And so I have my mom to thank for that. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and I do want to talk about kind of what you need to make theater and what you need to make theater, because you have made theater on a shoestring, barely a shoestring.
Yeah.
But when did you really know that this was your calling? Was it at that moment seeing Peter Pan, or when did you
probably
start
right about,
to get
it probably
active?
Was right about that age. I mean, I knew from when I was a little kid that I loved acting. My first play, I was my second grade play, and I just fell in love with it. And then I went to a summer camp that did plays. It wasn't specifically a theater camp, but did plays in it, and I was always in those and loved them. And then, did the school show. I was just really into it. And then when I was, I think a senior in high school, I started to realize that maybe I was interested also in directing. And that interest, like, I stuck with me still. I'm still interested in that.
Fascinating.
Yeah, weird.
And so let's talk about your exit then. Your exit from high school. How did you decide to go to college? What college did you decide to go to?
I went to Brown University, and that's actually a great question, because I was torn between several schools, and I had an acting coach in New York City at the time who gave me probably the best advice I could have gotten, which was, go to the best school that you can get into. Don't worry about it being a theater school if you later in life decide you need to get a theater degree for some reason or another, do that, but that's not gonna be the thing that gets your career going. And it was great advice, because I probably wouldn't have ended up at Brown if it wasn't for that advice. And just like, boy, that would have been a dumb choice.
Yeah. And a lot in the theater, you know, does inspire you. And I know you talk a lot about being in the theater and other writers that inspire you, but what at Brown did you latch onto, or did how were you informed by other things that had nothing to do with the theater?
I just need to back up for a second, get a 30,000 foot view here. This is like, you are the Terry Gross of Austin, Texas.
Eat your heart out, Terry Gross.
These are like the best questions. I never get asked these questions.
Well, disclaimer here. I've been listening to this interview that Owen Edgerton, I'm producing a new podcast with Owen Edgerton. Anyone? Woo! Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Owen interviewed Jason and for about an hour and a half one day. And it was such an incredible interview. And I've listened back to it while I'm editing it. And I'm thinking, there is so much about this guy that I don't know. And so I'm very curious in your life.
Well, gee whiz.
You know, that's why we're doing this.
All right. Well, anyway, so yeah, in college at Brown, I'm sorry to do this. I'm getting just the teeniest bit of feedback. Oh, there we go. It's gone. Thank you. So in college, I was, they had this student theater at Brown called Production Workshop. And it was totally fully produced plays that the students did entirely by them. And when I say fully produced, the budgets were nothing. It was like $500. But it was like a theater that was just for, by, and about the students themselves. And Brown also at that time had a phenomenal new play program. Paula Vogel, who's, after I graduated, won a Pulitzer Prize for playwriting. But she was the playwriting teacher there, and they had this phenomenal new play festival that happened kind of in the department's theaters as well. So I got this phenomenal, it was perfect for me, like from the beginning. I mean, I directed my first play, I proposed my first play to direct there when I was a freshman. You know, it was the first show of the year when I was a sophomore at this theater production workshop, and was directing continually working with playwrights and developing new work. And I produced on my own my very first show when I was 19. This is a pretty funny story, actually. So it's a play called Poker Eye. And the premise, actually, was basically, do you all remember in Star Wars when Han Solo is sitting in the bar and Greedo comes up to him, and Han sort of distracts Greedo with his fingers up above him like this and then shoots Greedo? Do you all remember that moment? Yeah. So this play basically took that moment of Star Wars, but put it as two kind of gangsters up against one another. It was a little 20-minute play that culminated in this moment of distraction and then ended just before the gun gets fired, all right? So me, this clever 19-year-old kid, decides, how cool would it be to do that show in its actual setting, a restaurant, do it site-specifically, and not tell the audience that it's gonna happen? So I found a restaurant, Louis, that was willing to go along with this insane experiment of firearms in public. And we did the show, and it ended, and I can't believe I actually did this, but anyway, and these guys on the rugby team came up to us after. And one of them literally physically picked me up and told me he was going to throw me through the plate glass window. But anyway, so the campus paper wrote about this. And then, lo and behold, CNN's headline news picked up on the story. So for a little 24-hour window back in the days before there were other 24-hour news media outlets, so when headline news was it for the 24-hour news cycle, anyway, so when I was 19 years old, the first play I ever produced got on the national news.
It is a different world now, you know? But that's funny that I started with a Tom Stoppard quote, and, you know, it's kind of your Rosencrantz and Guildenstern moment.
It is my Rosencrantz and Guildenstern moment. moment of complete blathering idiocy. Yeah.
So after college, is that when you decided to move to Austin and to go out on your own and to do theater?
So when I was in college, as I was graduating, I, like probably most people graduating, really had no idea exactly what I wanted to do with my life. But I thought maybe I was interested in teaching. And because of all of my extracurricular work working on making theater, I had spent extremely little time focused on the actual classroom work and didn't even know if I was even interested in classroom work. So I kind of begged the department there to let me stay on for a master's degree just to even see if I was, like, if I could even do the schoolwork. I literally had no idea if I was capable of that. So they did let me stay on, and I discovered very quickly that, yes, I was totally capable. I discovered very quickly that, like, the way to get A's is to do the reading. Huh. I missed that one as an undergrad. Yeah.
You don't have to do that in theater.
No.
You don't have to read.
Well, the other thing I discovered is all these kids who I thought were so darn smart, because I stayed on, you know, so also didn't do the reading. But I discovered that because now I was doing the reading, and they were talking out of their asses.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, it was, Brown.
Brown. Two kids too smart for their own good. So but over the course of being there in grad school, I came up with this, me and a playwright friend of mine, David Bucci, came up with this idea for creating a theater company that would be kind of by, for, and about our peers. And this was right at the time that the term Generation X started to be used by the mainstream media and was used extremely disparagingly about us. And I really kind of took that personally, like the idea that why would I ever want to work for somebody who has so little faith in my capacity to do for them, you know? And was so fearful of me, you know? And so so the idea came about to like take what we had learned through production workshop and through the new play program, you know, the new play festival there, and apply that to the real world and like start a theater company where we'd actually do that, but for the general public. And so then it was like, where were we going to do it? And I knew I didn't want to stay in Providence. And so I did three, there were three key criteria for picking a city for this theater company that I would start. It was that it had to be a young population, so that the audience was there for the work. It had to be a city without a big theater scene, because I didn't want our company to be overshadowed by a major regional theater, and kind of wanted to be a big fish in a small pond. And the third criteria was that at the time, my only transportation was a motorcycle, so it was essential that I be somewhere warm. And I went to the census rolls and started doing research. I actually went to the library, at the end of the process, Austin was the only city in the country that met all three of those criteria. So, yeah, I didn't know a soul moving down here. I did actually move here with all my stuff in my saddlebags on my motorcycle, and within, I guess, I moved here in August of 93, and in February of 94 was when Salvage Vanguard Theater produced its very first play.
So, oh my there goodness. You go. Yeah. What a story. So, you know, it's really interesting to me, this idea that you wanted to comment kind of on this backlash toward Generation X, and you did it in the theater. And through the theater. And I was just having a conversation with someone the other day, and I asked them, you know, I don't know where the conversation is now. You know, where is it in cinema? Is it in literature? Is it in the theater? Like, where is this conversation about our society and about what's going on, and how do we add our voice to that? Why did you choose or think that theater had power at that time? Was it just so powerful to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was part of it. I think I always wanted to do theater, so theater was the, you know, was the mechanism for this idea. And but I think part of it was, you know, the first 2 years of Salvage Vanguard Theater were performed at a rock club that no longer exists in town called the Electric Lounge, and we purposely did it in a space that was not a theater space. And right around that time, I came out with this bumper sticker that said, I hate theater. So I had a, I think, kind of complicated relationship with the art form that I was working in, you know, because in some ways, I did hate it. You know, like, when I founded Salvage Vanguard Theater, the most produced play that year was a play called I'm Not Rappaport, okay? Now, this is a play about two older guys sitting on a park bench talking to each other. And at the same time as all these regional theaters were producing this play, they were complaining bitterly about how awful it was that young audiences weren't coming through their doors. And it was like, well, hello. I mean, you know, it would help if you put young people on the stage, you know? So that was very much in reaction to that, you know? So I always wanted to work in the medium, but I wasn't necessarily interested in working in the sort of traditional ways in which that medium works, and I'm still not interested in working in traditional ways in which that medium works. But I also think, like, theater, I actually didn't give any thought whatsoever to that piece of the question. Like, theater, well, no, that's not true. You know what? Sorry, I'm thinking aloud here, but we did talk a lot about, you know, television versus theater, and television being this sort of static form where you sit back and you're sort of you're watching this screen. And, you know, at the time in particular, television, you know, didn't have the renaissance that it had had now, you know, so it was just mainly bad, you know, so it was like, well, we could do this thing that's interesting and good and live and that builds a community. And one of the things I remember right after my first daughter was born, when she was about 2 years old, I'm Jewish, and we started looking into going to maybe joining a synagogue. And when we went to that, what I discovered, it was very reaffirming from a sort of doing theater standpoint. Synagogue happens on Friday nights, and of course Friday night is a work night for me because I'm in the theater. So what I realized was at the synagogue, what happens is you show up early, you're chatting with your friends, you go in, you see this ritual slash sort of performance that maybe helps you think about the world in a way that you hadn't thought about it before, or maybe is just really boring. And then afterward, there's something called Oneg Shabbat in the synagogue where you go and you all gather around a big table with food and you eat and chat after the service. And I realized that experience was exactly the experience that happened in the theater, right? Like, exactly. We would show up in the lobby, we'd shoot the shit with our friends, then we'd see the play that hopefully gave us a new perspective on life, but also might possibly be really boring. And then afterward, instead of food, we would gather around a bar and drink beer. But the sort of spiritual, for me at least, that there was the spiritual aspect of it was actually quite similar. But for
ritual,
me,
maybe.
Yeah, and the sort of the sort of reflection on society piece of it, the connection to your fellow man. The idea of maybe, you know, when it's at its best, you know, having a truly transcendent experience. Yeah. And that was really when I decided, decided I'd way rather be doing theater than going to synagogue. So we ended up not joining the synagogue.
But you stayed in the theater.
But I stayed in the theater.
And you're offering transcendence.
Trying to, anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that magic of the Peter Pan moment is still very much alive.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So let's fast forward through Salvage Vanguard and start with the beginning of the intergalactic nemesis. Where did this begin? What was this nugget?
All right, the nugget was Salvage was in its second year, so this is 1996, and we at that point had never produced a play within an actual theater, and we were continually looking for alternative places to do work, and a friend of mine, Ray Colgan, who worked at Little City Espresso Bar and Cafe downtown at 9th and Congress, came up to me one night. We were probably at Emo's, you know, and he was like, hey, what would you think about, you know, doing plays in the coffee house I work in? And I have this idea for a play, and it would be a sci-fi radio play. And what do you think? And immediately came to my mind was Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the idea of creating a story like that, but that all the special effects, visual special effects, would be created in the audience's mind. So instead of having to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to create that experience, we could spend nothing to create that experience. And I was 7 when Star Wars came out and 12 when Raiders came out, and the idea had it. And we were interested in doing work that was different in different places than a theater and also was different for us. So even though radio plays had been around, we had never tried that kind of auditory storytelling before. And so it just seemed like a total no-brainer.
And that's so how it happened. You just started it in the coffee shop.
Yeah, so here's how
we recorded those.
We did, and here's how it worked. So it was extremely quick. The point was really to kind of put the least amount of hard work, make it just the most fun possible. So the least amount of work possible. That's still kind of the way I try to operate. So what we did was we gathered 4 writers, and they were Ray Colgan and a writer named Jessica Reisman and Lisa D'Amore and Julia Edwards were the 4 writers. And Ray wrote the first episode, like starting on Monday. He handed that episode off on Wednesday to Jessica. Jessica would write her episode Wednesday to Friday and then hand me the 2 scripts. Now keep in mind, computers still are not ubiquitous. So I think both scripts were actually typewritten. And I would get those Friday night. Then I would immediately get on a telephone, remember those? And I would start calling people that I knew to try to fill the roles that these guys had written in the script. I didn't even know what I knew the main characters, but I didn't know what the secondary characters would be. And we didn't do any double casting back then. So I literally would spend probably hours on the phone trying to track people down to get them to commit to a rehearsal the next day where we took about 2 hours to work through the 2 episodes. Then me and Buzz Moran would rummage. We actually rehearsed in Buzz's friend Tony's house, even though Tony wasn't there. So we would rummage through Tony's kitchen and closets to try to find gadgets that made the sounds that were called for in these scripts. Then the next day, Sunday, I would go back to Tony's house with Buzz, and I would read every line, and we just work through the sound effects, sound effect by sound effect. And then that would take about 90 minutes, and then we would pack it all up and race as fast as we can to Little City Coffee House, set up all our gear, set up the sound system, set up the highly sophisticated recording equipment, a cassette tape 4-track. And
this is 95?
This is 1996, summer 96.
Okay.
And then do the show. And so the first week, we had no idea if anybody was going to even show up, you know. And not only did people show up, but they packed the room, and there were people outside the plate glass windows of Little City peering in from the street trying to watch. I mean, it was so amazing. And then that exact process, which took a week, repeated for 5 weeks. So at the end of it, we had 10 episodes of this thing, The Intergalactic Nemesis, which started great and then progressively just got more and more first drafty.
And KUT broadcast tapes.
Right. So Kirthy Fix was one of the actresses who was in that show. And she volunteered for this thing that KUT used to do called SoundSight, which was reading newspaper articles on the air for people who were blind and visually impaired. And that was a Sunday morning show back in the day. And they were continually looking for volunteers to read. So Kirthy said, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And I said, yes. I think she might have even been one of the producers on it, actually. But Mike Lee, a very young Michael Lee, was also one of the producers. And so I volunteered. And so after a year of volunteering and doing this week after week and having a lot of fun, I sort of threw out the idea, because every Sunday they would read a children's book. And so I was like, what if instead of the children's book, you just broadcast 1 episode of our radio drama? And we did that, 10 episodes, there's roughly 10 weeks in the summer. Why don't we do that for a summer? And amazingly, Mike and Bob Branson also was involved, said yes. So the summer of 97, that radio serial actually got broadcast.
So fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and that story just, it speaks to this idea that you were really working with all the resources that you had. Like, every connection that you had, everything that you had at your disposal, you were trying to find kind of this workforce, mm-hmm. you know, on a shoestring. When did you get the idea that you wanted to branch out and you weren't going to look at home anymore? You wanted to take this play on the road? Because I know, it's fast forwarding a little bit, you were going to take the play to Broadway.
Yeah.
And you mentioned in another interview that you kept looking outward, but everything you had was right here, and you never really realized mm-hmm. it. You know, what was the impetus for looking outward as opposed to staying home?
Well, that's a really good question. So with Salvage Vanguard Theater in general, it started to feel like